There's a new world coming. It's already here. There's a new world on its way. There's a new world coming. It's already here. Let's begin to live that way.
Welcome to the Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcast series. The following presentation was recorded live at the 2012 CYNKC conference organized by Dave Sinis and others in Washington, D.C., and presented by Calvary Baptist Church, Woodlake Publishing, Virginia Theological Seminary, and Emergent Village. On May 7 through 10 of that year, conversation partners from seven countries and over 20 denominational traditions gathered to question, share, and be inspired by the alternative trajectory children and youth ministry is taking in certain contexts. Here now, a panel conversation on children, youth, and violence in the Bible, moderated by Carl Stauffer, with participants Almeda Wright, Ivy Beckwith, Brian McLaren, John Westerhoff, and Melvin Bray.
Okay, that's helpful. And my own, for what it's worth, my own answer to that is no, they must not die for justice to come. But in the face of their death, God can be in that situation. God did not cause it. God did not want it. It shouldn't have happened. It didn't have to happen. But but God can be in that moment. And so there can be some redemptive action, some redemptive qualities that come out. I pray Trayvon cannot be brought back to us, to his family, but I pray that we're going to be having some conversations and some actions are going to be taken because of that boy's death. God is in that activity. So that's what I mean by some redemptive quality.
And one of the things that actually was interesting for me, or one of the places where I had hoped the sermon would move, mm-hmm. or the particular rallying of the community would move, was how as a community might we respond. The pastor mm-hmm. wanted to move too quickly, though, mm-hmm. to making sense out of senseless death. Mm-hmm. I think part of our work as communities of faith is that we sometimes have to sit with that which is senseless.
Okay, we're together on that. I think we have to sit and grieve and get angry. All of that has to happen. But I think God can be in that, and yeah. there can be some redemptive outcome, pray, to all of this.
And I think that goes also back to questions of redemption and what that means.
There's and I think the question then becomes, when do we question the system? And get off of the personal, individual, mm-hmm. reconciliatory forgiveness that may or may not happen. When do we move this conversation to the system?
And that's our work, to move it to the system.
And why was this black pastor in a black church asking black people to forgive when the system hadn't even made it newsworthy yet?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have wanted a white pastor to do it either. But I do understand that, you know, we have a little bit different.
Yeah. Okay.
Watching this, being a part of this, there's a lot of interpretive, what does it mean to interpret? Mm-hmm. How do we read the Bible? What's our theory of atonement? And one of the most powerful things was being fully present, listening mm-hmm. to people speak their own pain and reaction. And I was taken back to a moment with my daughter, who was 10 and has Down syndrome, in a Greek Orthodox cathedral, standing before a crucifix, saying, "Mommy, they killed him, he's dead." And she wouldn't move to the picture of the resurrection. She was gonna be there in that moment. And she still goes back there. And she makes me go back there. And I worry that part of what we do is move away from our pain into resurrection. We get to Easter as fast as we can when the cross mm-hmm. is still here. Mm-hmm. And we have to be strong enough, given the resurrection, to be with people in that pain and to live there and to hear the whole story and just share it, be there.
Thank you.
Sure. For the past 3 years, I have been embarking on a confusing love affair with Rene Girard. And Mary Hunter, I blame you. It's your fault. And the language that I hear you using, and you actually mentioned his name last 2 nights ago, Brian, that of mimetic desire, of scapegoating, the scapegoating mechanism, the systems which still involve us in the scapegoating mechanism, whether we want to or not. We sometimes, not sometimes anymore, we have no choice except for the choices we make in Christianity. And then how do we then work to take the very complicated and confusing language of Girard and explain that to children and youth, that they do have that choice to walk away from the scapegoating mechanism and allow Jesus Christ and allow Martin Luther King and allow Malcolm X to be the last scapegoats for the love of God. Good luck answering that.
We'll make some notes on Rene Girard. Yeah.
One of the things that I haven't heard touched on yet is video games. And I recently had a conversation as I was journeying to Philadelphia with a high school sophomore, and he's inundated with video games, Call of Duty, you name it, that takes the narrative of history and places it into a fictitious world where they can enter into it. And this student has been very deeply involved in these games and posts stuff on his Facebook all the time. And he told me that he wanted to join the Army Rangers. And I started talking with him. What I found out was what he was looking for was for the third dimension. Mm-hmm. So he was experiencing the first two on the screen. Mm-hmm. And then now he wanted to live into the third, forgetting that the third dimension was flesh and blood and story. So we were talking. I was like, oh, God, how do I respond to this student and say, don't join the Army Rangers. It's sinful. I know, or whatever, like, without wrecking his worldview, causing problems in the home and whatnot. So I was just like, okay, God, meet this student where he is. Only you can transform his heart. And so we drove into Philly, and we're sitting down meeting with some homeless folks, and he got placed at a table with a homeless vet. Mm. And the vet sat down and said, you know, I wanted to join the army, and I was all about war and wanted to solve the problems of the world through the Marines. And then I went to war, and now I'm an advocate for peace. And he said, because I saw the other side of war. And this student, I heard about the story as we were driving home from Philly. And he told me, he said, I think it can be a little bit more creative than violence.
Yes.
I haven't told that kid, but I said, I'm going to tell your story wherever I go. But one of the things I'm wondering is, how do we do two things? Engage the video game world that is celebrating the narrative of violence and capturing that imagination, as you all spoke about. At the same time, how do we engage the student who says, when I graduate high school, I want to join the military because it'll pay for my education, or my parents are a military family, knowing that deeply some of that stuff that they're going to be practicing is going to conflict with the gospel. And so that's a question that I have.
Okay. You want one more? I wanted to ask a question about how we interpret biblical texts of violence. And Brian, I think you're right that the Bible is sort of has this debate about violence. I think there's lots of other debates in the Bible that you can find, you know, arguments on both sides. I think what I heard you say, though, is that Jesus resolves that debate in the direction of nonviolence or peace. And I think I don't totally agree with that. If you think about Jesus in Revelation, or if you think just in general about the way that Paul and others in the New Testament talk about Jesus' death, and it's intrinsically an act of violence and the blood of the Lamb and all of that. And so my question, I guess, is why do we have to have that debate resolved? Especially when I think a lot of the sort of Christological resolution ends up, in effect, people just dismissing all the violence texts because Jesus made it all better, or that's, you know, I don't believe that because I believe Jesus. And why not take a more midrashic or Jewish approach and say this is a debate that's not resolved in the Bible, but instead invites us to be a part of it and to engage in it and to find with God now our own resolutions that are never resolved in the text itself.
I apologize for throwing a bit of a curveball here, but all of the discussions that we've had about violence so far have been between two different parties. And there's a growing sense of self-destructive behavior and violence against the self, especially in my youth group in terms of cutting, in terms of self-mutilation. Thoughts of that came up during the kind of seedlings of discussion about atonement and the suffering language, that if Jesus is God and God is Jesus and God suffers like this, then is it okay for us to suffer like this? Can we cut? Can we mutilate? Can we have that piece? So there were seedlings of that discussion, I think, that were part of the earlier, and I would be fascinated to kind of hear that, a few thoughts on violent behavior against the self, and what are the theological ramifications of that. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I was struck by what you said of that you wanted to, wanting to rechannel the passion of violence, and you were speaking about child soldiers. And my situation is much less extreme. I have a 5-year-old son, and I see that passion of violence, that competitive nature and the running and jumping and rolling and being physical all the way through the day. And I see the passion, and my question is, how do I channel that into something that is not violent and that can be passionate and risky for Jesus?
Mm-hmm. I have two small kids that get into fights, you know? And I've always like, Jonah, don't hit your sister. Don't, even if she hits you, don't hit her back. But, you know, if he's on the playground and some kid comes after him, I kind of want him to defend himself. So I kind of find myself torn between eye for an eye and turn the other cheek. And so in teaching our small children, you know, at what point do we teach the turn the other cheek? Or is that kind of a Holy Spirit-driven moment when we do that? Because I'm not sure you can really appreciate turn the other cheek until you know that the norm is you're going to get hit back.
Okay, maybe I'll say something about the question about Jesus and violence and Paul and violence. And we are all, those of us who have learned the Bible for many, many years, we all come in a tradition of the way we learn the Bible. And a lot of people come from the tradition I came from, an evangelical fundamentalist. I had good charismatic sprinkles on top. And, you know, that's my background. And every verse in the Bible, we know how to fit into that framework. And when penal substitution is at the center, and a lot of you don't understand this because you weren't brought up with it, but those of us who were, every verse in the Bible, we know how to interpret in relation to that framework. And to question that is absolutely monumentally disruptive. And so for some of you in the room, I can imagine it being extremely disruptive to hear that be questioned. And all I'll tell you is I never questioned it until probably 10 years ago. And I didn't question it because I had a problem with it. I questioned it because other people had a problem with it, and I listened to them. And all I'll say is, if you want to leave here being loyal to that theory of atonement, just be aware that it can become a loaded weapon. And if you're going to keep it, you better find a way to put the safety on the gun. Okay? Now, I'll tell you what has happened to me. Every single verse that I found in the Bible, I found a way to interpret it that does not fit in that framework. And if you, and when René Girard was brought up, there is a way of interpreting the Bible that says the primary theme of the Bible is that human beings are destructive, have become destructive. God made us good to be creative. Original sin, in a sense, is our bent toward being destructive of ourselves, of creation, of one another, of everything good that God makes. We end up destroying rather than augmenting and joining God in the creativity. And that the entire story of the Bible is the story of us being turned and healed from our destructiveness and restored to the image of God. That God is not violent, that there is no violence in God at all. And that we're being restored, that in our violence, we made God in our image as violent, and violent as violent people, we could only understand God in terms of violence. It's where we were. But that in Christ, God is revealed to us, not in the one who punishes, but in the one who suffers. So your pastor, I mean, in a sense, he had a great opportunity on Communion Sunday to say, where was God in that shooting? God is always in the victim. And when we understand, we think we're doing good and we're killing God. And we do it in the name of all kinds of things that sound good. But when you get to the book of Revelation, and this is my favorite example because people, the book of Revelation either subverts Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or it reinforces it. And there's one small detail in the text that I always like to point out to people. In Revelation, I forget the numbers, 21, when Jesus comes in on the white horse, and I always hear this verse pointed, even Jesus is violent. People miss the small detail that he has a sword coming out of his mouth, which seems to me to suggest that perhaps that passage should be taken figuratively and not literally.
Thank you.
Which is a way of saying that the word of Jesus, the call to reconcile, to repent, to change our ways, to follow, to imitate his example, that is more powerful than the swords of Caesar. That the stand your ground of turning the other cheek is more powerful in the spirit of Jesus than the stand your ground of pulling your weapon. Now, it's a lot more complicated than that, but I think that's maybe all that should be said because of time. I'll just add that this has enormous implications for what we do in teaching children. Because suddenly, if we take seriously that we get into violence because of our propensity to imitate one another's desire, which turns us into rivals, and our rivalry is what sends us into violence. That's what James says in that passage. Our acquisitive or competitive desire turns us into rivals. That leads us to conflict, which leads us to violence. Then what our job in spiritual formation in the way of Christ is all about is teaching children a different model to imitate. The model of Jesus, who loves to give, who has all the passion, but it's not the passion to take, it's the passion to give, and not the passion to destroy, but the passion to create, and not the passion to dominate, but the passion to celebrate. And discovering this alternative imitation has everything to do with kids and youth ministry. We could throw adults in there too.
Stealing the questions that I wanted to answer. Exactly. No, but you did a fine job. So. So let me just speak to that whole issue of the turn the other cheek, the child on the playground, the kids, you know, siblings fighting with each other. I would say that we always teach kids what Jesus said. I mean that we don't have any compromise on that. And again, we talk about context and interpretation, but all that aside, I think we teach kids what Jesus said. And if Jesus said to turn the other cheek, then we teach kids to turn the other cheek. In saying that, however, I certainly am not going to fault Melvin for carrying that open knife on his way home at night. I sometimes walk the city streets in New York at night and wish I had an open night just because it can get scary sometimes. So that being said, Marjorie Thompson has written a lovely little book, some of you are probably familiar with it, called Family, the Forming Center. And in that book, she talks about the family as being the laboratory, I forget what she calls it, the laboratory for soul formation or something like that. And she talks about that very thing, that when you live in a family together, there are going to be conflicts with each other. You know, nobody has a conflict-free laboratory, a conflict-free family. But what she says is, it's the family is then, because of that, and then because of taking the teachings of Jesus seriously, the family is the first place where the child learns how to live in reconciled relationships with each other. The family is the first place where the child understands and learns how to forgive someone and learns what it feels like to be forgiven. And so all of these things that we're talking about, justice and nonviolence and conflict resolution and so on, they're modeled and can be modeled in the family from the very beginning. And, you know, and I think, you know, this sort of goes, I think, a little bit to back to the video game question. And I feel like I'm going to give a really simplistic answer, but here's what I'm going to say, and you can take it for what you want, is that, you know, we as youth pastors or people who work with kids in the church can only do so much. We can't physically, you know, rest and violently pull the video games out of the television console or whatever. So much of that has to do with parents. You know, we sang a song this morning during worship, and I'm going to get the words wrong, something about how, you know, people who follow Jesus act strange. Well, it's true. I think people who follow Jesus, maybe we ought to act stranger than we do. But if our families get that these video games aren't good for their kids and stand up and say, even though their kids are going to be strange and may hate them, this is what we do because we're a family that follows Jesus. But we, as the people who work in the church, can only do so much. So there's a real, I think, a family piece in that that starts very, very young in the determining that our family, we're going to be a family that follows Jesus, and this is what this looks like, and we're going to be different. And it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle when you haven't done that from the very beginning. But again, that's not a full answer, but it's a piece of kind of what you deal with that.
So in terms of, I want to respond a little bit to, I think, the question around self-destructive behavior, but also to follow up on the video game. Kathy Turprin, in her book Branded, as well as in a shorter article that she's written, talks about, and this point is talking about consumer culture, but it applies, I think, to also the question around video games and violence. Their practices of how parents and youth workers help young people engage the media that is the sea in which they live. There is, of course, the idea of abstinence. We can ask them just abstain from all things, you know, video game-wise.
And I wasn't necessarily suggesting
that. No, I didn't think you were either. That's one ideal situation. But there's also the practice of contestation, where we sit with young people and raise questions about what it is that they are doing while they are doing it, so that the narrative that they are hearing as they're even doing what we consider mindless game rituals has something interrupting it. And there's a way in which we have to help them re-narrate even their leisure activities.
That's right.
And that's very important, because once they know that you are going to bother them while they're trying to lose themselves in the video game, it becomes a little less enjoyable. But part of that is what you really have to think about in terms of contestation. I think we're getting a sign that says we need to be quiet.
We need to be quiet.
Okay.
One thing, I'm very interested in ritual. And we forget how important they are in our lives. Rituals are not something you participate in or you don't. It's which ones you participate in and how do you judge them. Remember last night I pointed out about the spectator sports as the dominant ritual of every culture. It's why in the early church you could not be baptized and go to the games. The church knew it could not compete. If we didn't let people go to the games, there'd be nobody in church. See, we forget how those rituals form us. And Stanley Hauerwas, my old colleague and friend, has a new book out called War and the American Difference. And his main thesis is, war is America's central liturgical action by which we renew our sense of our being and our identity as a nation. Play with that.
And one last comment, Melvin.
All right. So I think of things very practically, right? So the two questions that jumped out to me are the same two that jumped out to everybody else here, right? But I think we're afraid of nuance. Mm-hmm. Like, we want simple answers, right? So it's either kill, which we all admit is wrong, right? Or it's be killed, which is just as nonsensical, right? And so I'm trying, the two parents there, to have a nuanced conversation with my children, where I'm telling my son, that energy that you have, that passion, that desire to want to do something physical, right? Do something physical about the injustice. Don't do something physical to be the injustice, right? As far as the video game is concerned, we need to make better video games.
I think we are going to need to close down this time. Thank you very much to the panelists, to the rich questions, and all the best as you continue the deliberations tomorrow. And go in peace.
The contents of this podcast episode are reproduced by permission of the presenter and Woodlake Publishing, under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations copyright. The Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcasts are produced by Melvin Bray and Dave Sinis. The music for the 2012 CYNKC conference and podcasts is contributed by Brian Moyer Suderman. Stay tuned for more podcasts and resources for children, youth, and a new kind of Christianity on the World Wide Web at children-youth.com and woodlakebooks.com.
Can you imagine the world restored, earth and heavens too? Right at home with the one who says, I am making all things new. It's a new world coming and it's already here.